Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. A national group that casts doubt on climate science was allowed to speak at the state capitol during the legislative budget session, and leadership wasn't impressed.
It was a pretty blatant attack on the governor and his policies.
And the FBI has a new initiative to gather more data about cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous people in Wyoming.
Okay, this is right there in front of them. Are they going to engage? And I've been encouraging people, you're not going to know unless you try.
A filmmaker is taking it upon herself to shoot her movie in Wyoming after the legislature has decided not to create a film incentive in the state. Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
In the middle of winter, a wildfire flares up and consumes whole neighborhoods outside of Boulder, Colorado. It turns Ariel's childhood home into ash and rubble.
Fire outside. We're evacuating.
The Burn Scar, Season 7 of The Modern West. Binge all 5 episodes plus 2 bonuses. Find them under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide 3 music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. We're halfway through the Wyoming legislature's budget session, and it started out a little rocky. A national group that casts doubt on climate science was given an almost 2-hour platform to speak during a state legislative committee meeting. It created division with the state Republican Party and spreading misinformation. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan has more.
The Earth isn't getting warmer. Photos of melting glaciers and dying polar bears are scare tactics. Climate change is a cult. These are claims made by the CO2 Coalition, a national nonprofit dedicated to disputing climate change.
We love a big carbon footprint.
The group's Gregory Wrightstone spoke before 5 Wyoming senators at the state capitol this month.
There is no climate crisis in Wyoming. There is no climate crisis globally.
The coalition argues that the data that shows warming trends is misleading and that we need to be adding more carbon to the air, not less, essentially burn more fossil fuels. And Wrightstone says that even if the globe is warming, it's a good thing.
It means an increase in growing season. Killing frosts end earlier in the spring, arrive later in fall. That's a good thing. That's a really good thing for agriculture.
These are actually pretty common climate-denying talking points that have been around for at least 35 years. But they're disputed by a vast majority of climate scientists like University of Wyoming's Brian Schumann.
I know warmer can be good for agriculture, but you know, a lot of intense heat waves and droughts is not necessarily good for agriculture.
Schumann has worked in climate science for 30 years, and he says global warming is causing things like water shortages and extreme wildfires, which has been well documented. Western states are facing a water system that's drying up. Fire seasons are getting longer and longer. Data shows that parts of the Rocky Mountains are burning more than ever in the past 2,000 years. Like the 2020 Mullen Fire in southeast Wyoming that burnt down 66 buildings and homes.
This is something that's really impacting people, really affecting their lives.
But Schumann says he's noticed this climate-denying rhetoric resurface in the last few years.
They are trying to create the perception that there's a debate among scientists and that certain scientists are being silenced, and that is absolutely not what's going on here.
But the 5 Wyoming senators listened intently to the CO2 Coalition's presentation, all casting their own doubt on climate science. Senator Bob Ide of Casper said believing in climate change is an attempt to
beat down human flourishing and enslave the people.
Senator Sherry Steinmetz of Lingle closed out the hearing with a nod to the future.
Well, thank you so much for educating us tonight. I know I've learned a lot, and it will help me as we craft policy for the state of Wyoming.
Now, many politicians in Wyoming don't feel this way and didn't attend. But President of the Senate Ogden Driscoll says the consequences of this rhetoric is very real. He was displeased by the hearing.
It was a pretty blatant attack on the governor and his policies.
The coalition and lawmakers in attendance pointed blame at Wyoming's all-of-the-above energy strategy, Governor Gordon's approach to climate change, which he acknowledges is real. Gordon's approach uses renewables, explores other industries like nuclear, and finds cleaner ways to produce coal.
Wyoming has more carbon sequestration projects than any state in the nation, and we're a huge leader on it.
There's also efforts with other fossil fuels. Jonah Energy has one of the larger natural gas fields in the country, based in southwest Wyoming. Vice President Paul Ulrich says they're reducing their emissions.
It's good for Jonah. It's good for Wyoming in the fact that we can continue to produce for a very long time a very clean source of energy the country desperately needs.
And Senator Driscoll agrees.
Virtually every large company is invested in some way in clean energy and climate change policy.
Driscoll says he's not going to argue whether climate change is happening. He doesn't need to. The majority of Americans do believe in it, and the market is following suit.
And to ignore that or to discriminate against them is very detrimental to Wyoming's economy.
Driscoll says he fears this divide within the state's Republican Party could affect future lawmaking. But so far this session, it hasn't slowed much down. Several bills that support the governor's approach to addressing climate change are moving through the lawmaking process. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan.
The potential sale of a parcel of land bordering Grand Teton National Park is shaping up to be a controversial land management issue facing the Wyoming legislature this session. State officials proposed putting the Kelly parcel up for auction to the open market a few months back, and that sparked mass opposition from conservationists who want to see it joined with the national park. Now, an amendment to the budget moving through the legislature could finally pave the way for that sale, if it survives. Wyoming Public Radio's state government reporter Chris Clements speaks to Jackson Democrat Senator Mike Guru, who's leading a charge to sell the Kelly parcel.
What do you say to folks who their opinion on the Kelly parcel is that it shouldn't be sold? It's a priceless asset. It shouldn't be the state shouldn't sell it at all. What do you say to that?
It's a great question. And the bottom line is that this wasn't started by me. It was started by a piece of legislation that was passed years ago that said we are going to study, monetize high-value properties in Teton County for disposal. So that lit the fuse, and the Office of State Lands and Investment has been working towards that goal because that's what the legislation says. I fought that legislation. I fought it because I would just as soon not have sold it. But if that's the will, and that was the will of the bodies to say this is what we're going to do, now it's like, okay, well, let's sell it. And so let's get the best return for the school children of Wyoming, because that's what the Constitution says. And what seemed to happen from my vantage point over the past year was that people felt that the appraised price that was agreed to by the state and the potential buyer, the National Park Service, as the value at 64 point whatever million dollars. In talking with legislators, talking with other folks, actually standing out on the parcel one afternoon with the Speaker of the House, he said, I think $100 million would be a fair price. And I said, okay, and been working towards that number. And the great folks at the National Park History Foundation, National Park Foundation, have worked tirelessly to try to say, get to a point where they would say, okay, because the difference, the federal government can't pay more than appraised price by law. And so philanthropy is going to have to step in to fill that gap. And so they have agreed to try. Why I put it in the budget instead of a bill was because I wanted to have it have a shelf life. The budget has a shelf life of 2 years. The reason why, as I said, we're doing this is because of a bill that passed a few years ago that will continue to live on until it's repealed. And so the state is going to have to keep trying to do something with it because that's the law. What I want to do is either sell it or not, but I want it to, if this passes, it's going to have a shelf life of the budget. And that's through the next biennium. And so the folks that are raising the money will have a window to do this deal. And the window will close in 2 years. Now, someone could amend that time to be shorter. They could amend it to do anything. I'm hoping that they don't. But right now, that is why I put it in a budget. Normal expenses of the legislature is what the budget's for. The Constitution says that this money goes to the Common School Fund. I said, okay, we are going to authorize $100 million to the Common School Fund from what? To sell the Kelly parcel. That's what this is all about. And so that's why it's in the budget, because we're just making sure that money goes to where it's supposed to go. Just like the Constitution says we've got to fund schools. Well, the budget has school funding all through it. So I believe it is A, constitutional, B, a normal course of government service, to of state government service to put that money in the budget and to put it towards the Common School Fund.
Let's say that the section on the Kelly parcel in the budget bill, an amendment does erase it from the budget bill and this effort fails. Do you think that state land managers would, again, maybe pursue the option of auctioning it off to private individuals?
Yes.
So that is kind of what's at stake here.
Absolutely.
Representative Walter's bill on the Kelly parcel failed to meet introduction, and I just wanted to ask you about that legislation. What's your thoughts on his take on what to do with the parcel?
Well, my take on that bill was that it was the numbers that were in there were aspirational, and I'm trying to be as charitable as I can here because I don't think anyone, including the bringers of that bill, had any intention that that was the value of that property. I think they were putting, my summation was that they were putting a value on it that was so high that it wouldn't sell. I understand their goal, but that leaves wiggle room and interpretation that, frankly, I wasn't comfortable with. Because they weren't willing to put terms like not less than. That's in the budget. Not less than. So it's not a subjective thing like, oh, we got 63, 67 million, so it's pretty close, so we'll do that. No. $100 million.
When you went to the parcel, and you saw it for yourself, obviously you represent Teton County. What was your reaction?
Oh, I've been on, by, and around that parcel for 40 plus years. It's in my district. It's in the DNA of everyone that lives in Teton County and that holds park values, holds our values of Teton County very close, as so many of us do. And so that parcel along with Antelope Flats, where like my good friend Andy Schwartz and former Representative Schwartz and the legislature put an effort through with a lot of the same players that they to get that parcel conveyed to the national park. And so it is, and it's not lost upon me. It's now the 101st anniversary of the founding of the Jackson Hole Monument, which became the Grand Teton National Park. Every politician from, local level to the state level fought that. Everyone that I've ever talked to that was involved has said it was one of the greater mistakes of their life. I'm hoping that the Wyoming legislature reaffirms a commitment that I think all Wyomingites have, that hardworking Wyoming families have, to the goals of a national park. And that's what this is all about.
Do you think that it's likely it doesn't make it. The section in the budget bill does not make it.
I've been here long enough to know everything's a possibility. And it won't be a done deal until the governor signs the budget bill and we're all on our way home. For me, that means by the time, after the governor signs the bill, after we gavel out, and I'm at about Rock Springs, then when I turn the corner there at Rock Springs and start heading up 181, 191 to Jackson, I stop and get gas and get a pop and then head north. That's when I'll believe.
Thank you so much.
That was a conversation between our state government reporter Chris Clements and Senator Mike Garrew, a Democrat from Jackson. Up next, we hear about another bill making its way through the session. It would help the hearing impaired community. This is Open Spaces.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Join us for the newsroom from the BBC, and we'll bring you a fresh and lively look at what's happening in the world. Using our extensive network of correspondents, we take you to the story as it breaks. Get the facts and hear the experts on the newsroom from the BBC.
Weeknights at 7 on Wyoming Public Radio, followed by Classical Wyoming from 8 to 11.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Wyoming is the only state in the U.S. that doesn't have a committee to advocate for the deaf community. When members of the community called on Laramie Senator Dan Furphy to fix that problem, he listened. With help from the governor's office, Furphy put together a bill to establish a committee for deaf people in Wyoming, as well as a budget to help those living below the poverty line get hearing aids. Wyoming Public Radio's state government reporter David Dudley speaks with Senator Furphy about the bill's beginnings.
So we're here today to talk about the hearing aid bill that you sponsored. How did that bill come about?
Over a year ago, I was asked to attend a meeting, and I said, sure, this was in Laramie. And when I went to the meeting, I was greeted by a group of deaf and severely hearing impaired people. And they said, no one will listen to us and we need help. Would you help us? And I said, well, absolutely, I understand. And they started explaining to me, Wyoming is the only state in our country that doesn't have a commission for the deaf. So they said, can you help us? And so I scheduled a meeting with Governor Gordon, and a big group of those people showed up here in Cheyenne. We met with the governor, and he was very sympathetic to them, saying, I understand.
Before you continue, may I ask, whenever you met with them, what was it that struck you?
They have serious problems in our state. Lack of interpreters. For example, they explained, we can go to a doctor, but we can't communicate with the doctor what our problem is, because most doctors don't have interpreters. And The one couple explained, our daughter was having severe health issues. We go to the doctor's office, and we couldn't explain what the problems were. The governor, as I said, was very sympathetic to this. And he assigned his senior policy advisor, Jen Davis, to work with me on this issue. And I was extremely impressed. Worked on developing a plan for these people called Heart of Hearing Services in Wyoming. And she put together findings on research, etc. And it's amazing the number of people we have in this state that are severely hearing impaired or deaf.
And this Senate bill then, or file I should say, this is the first step towards remedying that?
Exactly. This is just the first step. And as I said, we've got this long-range plan for helping these people, but we decided that's one thing I could work on is let's get this bill for hearing impaired people, and that's what this bill does. One of the benefits of what we're doing is we're making people aware of this situation, which is very important.
And, you know, if I understand correctly, you oftentimes can't tell whenever you're out in public if someone has a hearing impairment.
That is true. But the governor has also been good about providing interpreters to help those people. We just had a committee meeting last week, and the governor assigned an interpreter so these deaf people could attend online, and yet the interpreter relayed the discussions in the committee meeting to those people. And I understand a lot of them, some of them would be a 7-hour drive to come to a committee meeting, which would be very difficult, obviously.
What can we do in the community to help the situation?
In this year's budget, we do have one person allocated in workforce services that will hopefully deal with the deaf. And this bill that I'm proposing will assign a part-time person in the Department of Health to help these people get qualified for the very expensive hearing aids. You can buy hearing aids over the counter for less than $500. That won't work for these people. They need to be fitted, and they need a physician or audiologist to really help them get the kind of hearing aids that they need. And those are expensive, very expensive. But that's what we've got to get done for them.
What's the greater goal beyond all of this? What do you hope that this will achieve ultimately?
Long term, it would be great to have a commission for the deaf so we can have plans. One of my concerns is, and I think we're doing okay, but children. And we do have interpreters in the school districts, but some of them have only taken a course or two at our university. They're not truly, some are, but there are some that are not truly qualified to deal with the severe problems some of these children have in our state. And so we've got to take care of that too. But long term, a commission for the deaf to help these people and provide services statewide, more interpreters, and provide the equipment these people need.
Thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you.
That was a conversation between our state government reporter, David Dudley, and Senator Dan Furphy, a Republican from Albany County. For the past 2 years, Wyoming tourism advocates have tried to pass a film rebate incentive program through the state legislature. Filming in the state has its challenges, mainly because it doesn't offer financial incentives for filmmakers, like other states, including Montana. A film rebate incentive program wasn't introduced during the session this year, so advocates in Cody are taking another route to try to attract films to the region. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats reports.
Just the absolute variety of Cody, Wyoming. Everything you see on here is a piece of history.
A vintage rodeo poster, an elk mount, antique washboards. These are some of the items hanging on the walls, viewable from the dance floor at Cassie's Steakhouse, where Mike Canada is organizing an open mic night.
This next song I'm going to sing for you guys, this is an original song.
On a weeknight in February, a handful of locals munch on steaks and baked potatoes while they enjoy the music. But this time of year, the wooden dance floor is pretty empty. But later this year, actor Hannah Barefoot plans to pack this former brothel turned cowboy bar and restaurant with a film crew to shoot part of her movie, Midnight Clear. She says it's a Western set during Christmas, where a single mom tries to save her family's struggling dude ranch.
They always say, write what you know. And as I was starting to think about what this script would be, I just started to think about how much I love my hometown. I love Cody. I love Wyoming in general.
Barefoot says as the characters and the story started coming together, there was no question it had to be set in Cody, at places like the Irma Hotel, the Cowboy Palace Westernware Shop, and her family friend's dude ranch near Yellowstone. People in Hollywood like the idea.
But because Wyoming doesn't have a film industry, there's not a tax incentive, there's no crew. And so they were like, yeah, we love the script, we'll shoot it in Canada. Or we love the script, we'll shoot it in Montana or New Mexico.
Wyoming had a film incentive rebate program that got started in 2009, but it went through some budget cuts and it sunsetted in 2018. In 2019, the legislature voted not to continue it. Ever since, there have been efforts to bring it back. During last year's legislative session, Wyoming Department of Tourism Executive Director Diane Schober spoke to a committee about the program's success.
And during that time, there were over 30 productions that took place. And the economic contributions and qualified expenditures during that time were $18,329,000. Of that $18 million, $9,125,000 were in crew and salary and wages for Wyoming qualified workforce. That totaled 320 different crew.
In the proposed program, some productions could qualify for up to a 30% rebate for Wyoming expenses for things like hiring local staff and production equipment rentals. According to a document from the Wyoming Department of Tourism, the state is losing out to other states with film incentives, including projects like Wind River, Longmire, and 1883, one of the Yellowstone prequels. Kelly Estes runs the film office in Casper and a newly formed one in Cody. He told the committee last year that he scouted locations several times for 1883.
They wanted locations outside of Casper near Independence Rock. And we had things set up for them, but the incentive drew them to Montana since we didn't have that available to us.
A University of Montana study showed that in 1 year, 2.1 million people were inspired by the Yellowstone TV show to visit Montana. And when they came, they spent an estimated $730 million. At the legislative meeting, several members of the committee expressed concern over how Wyoming could be depicted in film projects, including Rollins Representative Donald Burkhart.
If a company, film company, came to Wyoming and met all of these requirements and produced a documentary that was derogatory and disruptive to our mineral extraction industry, would they qualify for these?
Cody Representative Sandy Newsom says even though the legislation ultimately received an 8-1 yes vote from the committee and was sent to the House for debate, it was not introduced on the House floor.
Well, I would like to bring it back, but there doesn't seem an appetite in the legislature for it at this point. We had a changeover of a lot of new members who are maybe ideologically opposed to incentives of any kind.
But for now, she's hoping the newly formed Cody Yellowstone Film Office will bring more business to Northwest Wyoming. The Park County Travel Council recently launched the film office. Ryan Houck is the council's executive director.
At the moment, we're not able to offer really any incentives, but if they are able to book their picture in that winter time, we can get very aggressive on hotel rates for them.
The film office has already negotiated hotel room rates for Barefoot's upcoming movie and is helping her hire local talent. Barefoot says she hopes filming it in Cody during the off season will give her hometown an economic boost.
And we want to then take this film that's done without a film incentive and then show, look how much we did without a film incentive. How much more could we do? How much more could we accomplish if there were a film incentive and if there were an actual industry that were a viable, you know, a viable economic industry for the state?
Barefoot's film, Midnight Clear, will be shot in Cody later this year. She anticipates releasing it before the holidays in 2025. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Olivia Wheats at the Center of the West in Cody.
Coming up, the FBI announced a new initiative meant to help address the missing and murdered Indigenous person crisis on the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces. Cheyenne Roundup is back for the 67th Legislature's budget session. Join Wyoming Public Media and Wildfowl Reporters for a weekly look at the problem-solving and power struggles at Wyoming State House. Every Monday of the session, starting February 12th, we'll preview the legislative week ahead, what bills have died, and what's still kicking. Find it wherever you get your podcast or tune in to Wyoming Public Radio on Monday afternoons or Tuesday mornings.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. The FBI recently announced a new initiative to gather more data about Native Americans who've gone missing or been murdered in cases that are still open. This issue has been a crisis for decades. Between 2011 and 2020, over 700 Native people were reported missing in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more on how the FBI is hoping to build trust with community members on the reservation.
John Washakie stands at a podium, wearing an orange button-up shirt and beaded rose bolo tie. The podium is draped with a blue cloth that reads Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Abigail Washakie was my niece. She had a family, a home, and then she drifted off and became involved with a person and came up missing for a few days.
The Eastern Shoshone Business Councilman is speaking at a press conference in Fort Washakie about a new FBI initiative addressing the missing and murdered Indigenous Persons Crisis, or MMIP.
She was murdered and put in a trash bin in Riverton.
Washakie says that while Abigail's case was solved thanks to the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, it often doesn't end that way.
And I can only encourage you today to come forward with information related to any unresolved cases or where you may know of some missing person.
The FBI is the main agency that investigates these sorts of crimes when they involve tribal members on the Wind River Reservation. And they've now set up a designated email account and tip line to collect new information from community members. Kara Chambers is the director of the Wyoming Division of Victim Services and the chair of the state MMIP task force.
I think it was really born out of that thought that, well, you know, you have citizens who are talking about lost loved ones in these cases that they've never gotten resolution.
In 2019, she had a conversation with the FBI Victim Services advocate. They realized that there's a need for more communication between the agency and community members.
They're like, well, you know, they keep talking about these cold cases, but, you know, technically we don't. I mean, any lead that we had was, you know, fully investigated.
So the FBI was saying there were no cold cases, but people on the ground were saying otherwise. Chambers says this new initiative gives families another chance to do a deeper dive.
And give that opportunity for these families who maybe didn't have the courage at the time or didn't have all the information.
Nicole Wagon is a Northern Arapaho MMIP advocate and serves on the state's MMIP task force with Chambers. She says there's a lack of trust of the agency on the reservation, which comes, in part, from a lack of visibility.
How do we get that into our schools that they're real and they do exist? People talk about it, but it's just like almost a figment of people's imagination if you think about it.
Wagon lost two daughters to the MMIP crisis and worked with state law enforcement to solve the murder of her daughter Jocelyn. She hopes the new initiative will be another avenue for bringing justice.
Okay, this is right there in front of them. Are they going to engage? And I've been encouraging people. You're not going to know unless you try.
Northern Arapaho Business Council Chairman Lloyd Goggles agrees. The former patrolman says he's seen the mistrust firsthand.
There is hesitancy amongst the public. You know, when they have the chance to divulge something, you know, there's a need to protect their own.
Special Agent Leonard Carollo oversees all FBI operations in Wyoming. He recognizes that tribal members haven't always been comfortable working with the agency in the past.
I would be remiss if I sat up here today and said that we've done everything correctly, that we have not made any mistakes. I can't say that. We acknowledge that. We accept that.
The FBI hopes to build that trust by hosting in-person MMIP information gathering sessions on the reservation. After 90 days, the FBI will start researching and investigating the tips they receive.
In situations where the FBI does not have jurisdiction, information will be forwarded to the appropriate agency.
Those with tips can email wymmip@fbi.gov or leave a message at 307-433-3221. Callers who leave a name and phone number will receive a return call. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Last summer, the nonprofit StoryCorps hosted an oral history project here in Wyoming, in which veterans and their families recorded honest and personal stories about their military experience. We're grateful to share those conversations now with our listeners. Today, we hear from 19-year-old Giselle Geronis as she talks about growing her confidence through ROTC, her experience as one of the only female cadets in Wyoming, and the importance of advocating for other women in the military.
My name is Morgan Ziffmeister. I'm 39 years old. I'm in Brooklyn, New York, and today I am interviewing Giselle.
Hi, my name is Giselle Geronis. I am 19 years old. I am currently in Laramie, Wyoming.
You had mentioned to me earlier that you're in the ROTC.
Yes, ma'am. So I did a semester of college, and I joined ROTC super last minute as a way to sort of like make friends. I started school during COVID, and so most things were closed. ROTC was one of the only in-person things on campus. And so I kind of joined it last minute, and then I kind of fell in love with it, to be honest.
So did you always have any kind of inkling that you might want to serve?
I've had problems kind of with my eyesight. Also in high school, I didn't have a lot of self-confidence, and so I didn't think the military would be for me. However, I joined ROTC and I did a semester, and sort of the personal growth I experienced there was unmatched and unlike anything I'd ever experienced. The best thing I've ever received out of the program was this summer. I was able to spend 3 months in Jordan. It's called the DoD Strategic Language Program. So they select ROTC cadets who they think have a capability for learning a language. I was lucky enough to be selected for Arabic. And so the last 3 months I studied at a university in Amman, learning the Armenian dialect. So,
wow. What was your favorite thing about, you know, going abroad or, you know, being in that area of the world?
It was amazing, man. I joined an all-female hiking group because the outdoors is my passion, and that was incredible. Just getting to connect with all of these like super badass Arab women. They were incredible, and they taught me a lot about the world, about love, about life. Some of the best kind of character lessons I've ever had came from those women on our hikes.
So cool. Yeah, my mind just sort of starts to wander to the sort of women in the military experience.
It's not always been easy, truthfully. For a while, I was the only cadet, one of the only female cadets in the whole state of Wyoming. Serving in the Guard, I was one of two, and then I became one of three. I'm currently in leadership in ROTC, and I am the only female in leadership. And so sometimes that can be kind of difficult. However, I am very grateful for my position, because I feel like I can advocate for women more so from my position. I've always believed that the responsibility of women in leadership is to support and advocate for other women. That's one thing I've tried to do. I believe I'm strong and resilient, and I think I can take, I guess, a bit more of a beating. And so I wish to kind of break through the barrier and make it possible for other young girls.
I'm wondering if there was anything, you know, different than what you imagined before you had joined the ROTC and the Guard.
I guess it was different in that I didn't think I would find as much of a family as I did. The females in ROTC, I think, particularly become very close. One of my best friends in the program became a cadet in the National Guard the same time as me. And so for a while, we were kind of the two of the three females in the National Guard together. And so we served in the same unit, in the same section, under the same incredible female leadership. And so we were both able to experience just this incredible amount of growth and just this really deep connection that I've never really had with anyone else. Her name is Shelby. She's incredible. And then I am currently in leadership in ROTC. I'm Alpha Company Commander. And my other best friend in the program, his name is Connor. He is Bravo Company Commander. And initially, funnily enough, we didn't get along. Last year, he complained and he thought I was sort of given a few opportunities because of my gender, more so than my merits. After working together this semester, he came up to me and apologized and said that wasn't true at all. And since then, he's become like my brother. ROTC truthfully has changed my life. Growing up, I was always very timid, very quiet. It's helped me advocate for myself.
A Wyomingite moved to Memphis during the Civil Rights Movement. She wrote a book about her experience. That's up next on Open Spaces.
I'm Caitlin Tan, and I grew up in Pinedale, Wyoming. And by about 10 years old, I came to love public radio. Wyoming Public Radio is the one public radio station for the state. And so Wyoming Public Radio really is the one thing that kind of unifies the whole state and makes us all feel like just one big community.
Do you love Wyoming Public Radio? Let us know at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadalska. Wyoming author Shelley Moore grew up in Memphis in the 1960s. Her memoir, Through a Blue-Eyed Lens, describes the experience of a middle school white girl, the black student who sent her a love note, and a city going through one of the most pivotal moments in American history. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger sat down with Moore.
Well, I have to give a tiny bit of background. I was seven when we moved to Memphis. Born in Laramie, ended up in Memphis when I was seven. And at that point, I, along with my siblings, I was a very sheltered, protected, privileged white girl. I didn't know any other world. And probably when I was in fifth grade, early 1960s, that's when Memphis City Schools started to become desegregated. And I will say that I always use the word desegregated when I talk about that time, because it was a legal format. Our schools were desegregated. They were not socially integrated. The elementary school, the junior high school, and the high school we attended were all white schools until the early 1960s. And so the desegregation process rocked a lot of boats and upset a lot of people, because there were generations of people who had attended those white schools who were not interested in the change.
The book is listed as a memoir, but the bulk of it is this young love story that's impossible to understand fully without describing its intrinsic connection to the civil rights movement, or the one that was kind of forced upon it. Can you talk about how you both experienced this transition from middle school crushes to the very thing that a lot of people did not want to see at that time?
It's kind of hard to to put all of this into context for listeners, but basically what happened in my world was that I was asked by a fellow student, a black student, to be his girlfriend in 1967 when we were in eighth grade. And that probably doesn't sound like a big deal to people listening now, because everywhere you go, there are mixed couples of every ethnicity and race and people having children. It was absolutely unheard of at that time. As far as we know to this day, we were the only interracial couple in the Memphis City school system. And I give all credit to my friend who asked me to be his girlfriend for his courage and his audacity and his charm. I mean, I don't know where it came from. I don't know how he got to that place, because as we all know, it was very dangerous for black boys and men to express any interest in white women and girls. It just wasn't done, even at that time in 1967. And I have to say that, honestly, it changed my life and informed the person that I am today.
And can you talk about how you both ended up involving yourselves in a lot of these social movements that were taking place at the time?
His father was a civil rights leader also and a minister. So we were very involved in school walkouts and marches in the streets and attending meetings and just generally, you know, kind of on the front line as young people of the civil rights movement at that time. So that's what was going on, you know, in the midst of our daily lives, which were trying to figure out how to learn together in a desegregated environment for the first time.
One of my favorite parts of the book is the description of the coffee house, this place where people who were deemed not the mainstream, let's say, could feel kind of safe. And there was almost a thought in me to compare it to online safe spaces, where a lot of people from around the world will flock to find comfort and support and often use it for activism as well, like you mentioned in the book. But I imagine it is pretty dramatically different. Can you talk about just how different the coffee house is from Safe Spaces now, and just how unique it was at its point in time in Memphis in the 60s?
Well, I'm old enough and old school enough that I don't think any type of technology replaces the personal touch or the personal look or the personal communication. That's just my personal take on the thing. It's hard to equate the two or to even sort of relate the two to each other, the two time frames, because I'm trying hard to think back on whether there was any place else where we could hang out in mixed groups. And I'm talking sexual orientation or racial couples or friends. I don't believe there was anything happening in Memphis at that time. And so the coffee house was absolutely a safe place. You know, it was where we went to talk, where we went to hear music, where we went to hear poetry readings. But mostly it was just a place where we could feel comfortable being together. I'll give you this example. My mom joined an interracial group with other parents to talk about what their children were dealing with on a daily basis. They met one time in a church basement in on the same street as my junior high and high school. And the parishioners of the church found out that they had met there as an integrated group. And they, after that first night, they were no longer allowed to meet there. That's how incredibly segregated Memphis still was. This was in 1970.
You mentioned in your book that you see parallels between then and now, implying that things might be better in some ways, but there's still an ongoing struggle. Do you think, even with as loud and as angry as discourse and movements can be today, that a lot of this is part of a healing process? Or do you find that the rhetoric and activism of today is bringing the country in a more opposite direction, in a more divided place?
I think we are where we are as a country because we have never dealt with the fact that this country enslaved Black people for centuries. We have never dealt with that. We have never come to terms with it. We have never admitted, acknowledged, taken responsibility for, and that's where the voices come through, the loudness comes through. And it's to me, to my thinking, from my experience, it's perfectly legitimate and necessary. And I think that white folks who want to join in that chorus should join in that chorus. But I don't think it's a kumbaya moment for America.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger talking with Shelley E. Moore, author of Through a Blue-Eyed Lens, a Memphis memoir. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, our producer, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Eric V. Hill, our social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.